For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
This is the second week we're spending in this biggest block of teaching that Luke has recorded so far, the biggest block of teaching of Christ in his book so far, called the Sermon on the Plain. And last week we saw that Jesus, he's been under attack from the Pharisees, the religious leaders. He wasn't following their rules. You know, they were very critical of him. And in this Sermon on the Plain, Jesus is launching an all-out attack on the religious system of the Pharisees. This is one that was based on self-righteousness, criticizing other people, pointing the attention to themselves, showing how good they were, and urging people by their works, essentially, to try to approach God on that basis. And Jesus is saying, no, you guys are not good enough. You've lowered the bar way too far. And what he's explaining here, as we saw last week, is that Jesus says to his disciples, if you throw in with me, you're not going to have the kind of rich, glamorous lives that the Pharisees are leading. Instead of being rich and famous, you're probably going to be poor, you're going to be rejected, and you're going to suffer. He also says that with these new enemies that you're going to make because you're my followers, you're not to retaliate or get revenge on those people. You're not to hate the people that hate you. Instead, you're to love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Well, this was pretty confusing. This would have been hard for them to understand because on the one hand, they had the Pharisees pointing a certain direction, a direction that they'd lived under their whole lives, that this was godliness, that this was spirituality. And here comes Jesus, and he's pointing the exact opposite direction. And it's confusing. And what Jesus is going to do, he's trying to move in here, and he's trying to clear up this confusion. He's trying to help them to see how they can tell a good teacher from a bad teacher, a good direction from a bad direction. And this is pretty helpful because today we also are faced with a lot of different voices vying for our attention, trying to get us to go a certain direction. You know, every time, you know, you're at school, your teachers kind of have one direction they want you to take. Every time you turn on the television, every commercial is pounding you with buy this, go this way, value these things. Your friends have a certain direction. They're encouraging you. They're pressing you, a certain value system. You know, you get on your Twitter account and, you know, you just see little, you know, blips, this, that. You know, there's all kinds of voices, all kinds of chatter. And it's confusing. We wonder, where is Jesus in all of this? What direction are we supposed to take in a world where we have access to more information and more perspectives than anyone at any time in history? You know, what they had was nothing to what we've got, the options that we have. And so Jesus, he's gonna clarify this for us. He's going to come in, and he's going to help us to see how to know who to follow. He's going to teach us discernment. And what he's going to give us here are five differences between good teachers and bad teachers, good leaders and bad leaders, good direction and bad direction. And so let's just start reading where we left off last week. We saw verse 36. He says, you need to be merciful just as your Father is merciful. Do not judge and you will not be judged. Do not condemn and you will not be condemned. Forgive and you will be forgiven. So this is kind of four ways of saying basically the same thing. And we see the difference here is the difference between condemning and forgiving. I mean, think about it. Think about how condemning the Pharisees were. And how different that was from Christ. You know, they're condemning him. They're condemning these poor sinners whom Jesus is trying to come and help. He's trying to come and heal them. They thought this guy was sick or paralyzed because he had sinned or because his parents had sinned. They thought the poor people were poor because they were sinners. And here Jesus is coming to them with compassion, with understanding, with forgiveness, with acceptance. And he couldn't have been any more different from these Pharisees. And so that's one mark that we see here that Jesus points out. Now, when we first look at this, it makes us wonder, is this kind of hypocritical? You know, here Jesus is saying, don't judge. And that's like one of the most famous verses in the Bible. Don't judge or you'll be judged. He's saying, don't judge. But what is he doing in this whole section? He's passing judgment upon the Pharisees and upon their way of life. He's condemning what they're teaching. He's saying, no, they're wrong. Which in our world, that's really, you're not supposed to say anybody's wrong unless the person's saying someone's wrong. And then you can say they're wrong. So is that hypocritical of Christ? And the answer is no. And to understand this, we need to distinguish between righteous judgment and sinful judgment. There is a righteous kind of judgment. You know, Jesus commands us. Later in Luke, he says, why don't you judge for yourselves what is right? He's holding them responsible to be able to judge the difference between right and wrong. He says in John 7:24, stop judging by mere appearances, but instead judge correctly. So in John, we see there's a wrong kind of judgment. It's a superficial judgment. And then there's a judgment that has discernment, that looks down deeper into the heart of the matter and judges correctly. And they're two different things. And so he's actually commanding, not only is he okaying, he's commanding his followers to know how to judge the right kind of judgment. And there's different things that would fall under righteous judgment. You know, we need to be able to discern the difference between truth and falsehood. Truth versus falsehood. You know, if you tell me 2 + 2 = 5, I'll be like, you're wrong. It's not because I'm arrogant. It's not because I like constructed some sort of mathematical system. It's not because I think I'm better than you. No, I mean, it just happens to equal 4. And, you know, anybody can take 2 apples and put them next to 2 apples and count the result and see there's 4 apples there. And so, you know, when it comes to truth about God and spiritual truths, there are certain things that God has revealed to us. You know, somebody might say, well, you know, I think God is one and God is a part of everything. And, you know, every rock and every tree and every creature, you know, they all have this, they have a name and a spirit. And I could be like, no, that's not true. God is a personal being. And God is not part of this clicker or that stool. You know, he made everything, or he made the things that everything's made out of. But he's not one with everything that exists. No, God is the God that stands out separate from his creation, over, above, sovereign over his creation. It's not like I made up that religious truth or that spiritual system. No, I happen to have good reason to think that God has spoken through his word, and he's revealed some truths about himself. If God has told us what he's like, it's not arrogant to affirm what he said about himself. And what Jesus is coming with here is he's coming with truth about what God is really like. It says Jesus is the ultimate revelation of who God is, who the Father is. And it's not arrogant to agree with Christ, to agree with God about what God says about himself. So we need to be able to discern between truth and falsehood. You can really wreck your spiritual life if you can't tell the difference between true and false. We also need to be able to distinguish between morally right and morally wrong. This is also something that God has revealed. And again, if we've got good reason to think that God has revealed moral right and wrong. And in fact, I can't come up with any basis for right and wrong that's not just constructed by humans and relative, that fits with the deep internal sense that there is really such a thing as right and wrong. And it's not just constructed by individuals or cultures or just a figment of our imaginations. And so God, there's a lot of things God says is wrong. You know, murdering, theft, judging, taking revenge, he says, are all wrong. We shouldn't do those things. And it's not arrogant for me to look at what God has said is right and wrong and just to agree with him. And so Jesus says, you know, there is a certain, and this is exactly what he's doing here with the Pharisees. He's criticizing them. He's criticizing their teaching about God, and he's also criticizing their ethics, which said it's super righteous to tithe 1/10 of your garden spices and to refrain from working on the Sabbath, where working is defined by their definition of working, and yet they're ripping off old widows and kicking them out on the street and taking all their possessions. And they're leaving people destitute and impoverished. And Jesus says, that is wrong, completely wrong. That's not the way God is, and that's not God's will. So we got to be able to judge between right and wrong, truth and falsehood. There is a sinful kind of judgment. You know, there's judging motives, for example. This is where we start judging things that there's no way we could know. You know, that's where I just kind of suspect that, you know, you've got prideful motives for what you're doing, and I'm confronting you and I'm judging you, and there's no objective outworking of that. I can just tell. And we can get to real big trouble in our relationships. If we start judging people's motives, we're treading on ground. Scripture says, look, God's going to bring the motives to light. If there's really a motive in there, it's going to come out in some kind of objective way. But we get into disaster in our relationships and our Christian community if we're judging motives. But also, criticizing others to exalt myself. That's exactly what the Pharisees were doing here. They're criticizing others to make themselves look more righteous. And unfortunately, this, Christians are known for this. David Kinnaman's book, Unchristian, he surveyed a bunch of non-Christians under the age of 30, and he said, check all these words that you think of when you hear the word Christian. And number three on the list was judgmental. 87% of the people surveyed checked the judgmental box when they thought of Christians. 50% of the Christians he surveyed checked the judgmental box. This is kind of what Christians have become known for, unfortunately. And it's exactly the opposite of what Jesus is saying here, that we should not be known as judgmental people, that if we've got to make a distinction between right and wrong, you know, we should do it with humility and with gentleness and kindness. And this is certainly not what Jesus was known for. The only people he was known for criticizing were the quote-unquote religious people. And, you know, they just went around, they just exuded self-righteousness, judgmentalism, and it's sinful judgmentalism. He said, these guys are wrong. They're completely wrong. And so what's our application of this first principle here? Well, you know, one, I think the primary application is this. If you've ever judged anyone unrighteously, if you've ever failed to forgive anyone, then you will be judged by God. That you will not be forgiven. Jesus says that here. He says it in other places as well. I mean, ultimately, he says you need to be perfect like your Heavenly Father is perfect. And if you've ever done anything wrong, if you've ever failed to forgive perfectly from the heart, if you've ever judged anyone to make yourself look better, then Jesus says, sorry, you've blown it. You're not good enough for God, and you're going to hell. But if we allow that truth to sink in, then that's what is the bad news that Jesus came to bring. That's not the end of the story. Jesus also came with good news, where he said, I came not to the righteous, but I came to those who are sick. It's the sick that need a doctor, not the healthy. And if you could admit you're sick, and if you could admit you're sinful, and if you could knock it off with trying to work your way to God and simply fall on your knees and receive his grace, that then you're understanding his teaching. Then you're starting to get the teaching of Christ. He's putting the bar up where it belongs so that it will drive us to our knees and it will drive us to receive grace. So that would be, you know, the primary application. In addition to that, like I said earlier, a Christian should be merciful and forgiving. We should be, you guys see that screen's up? Okay, good. We should be merciful and forgiving. And this is something we need to cultivate. You know, and where it comes from is, like it says, just as your Father is merciful. When we receive God's mercy, when we experience his compassion, when we experience his love, when we see how little we deserve everything that he's given us, you know, that's, you just, it's almost like you can't help turning and extending that same forgiveness to other people. It would be so hypocritical for us to receive forgiveness and not to extend forgiveness. And so, if we truly are believers and are, you know, we've been, Jesus, he's extending the opportunity to be adopted by God into his family, to be his son or daughter forever. And if, you know, if our dad is a certain way, we receive from him, then what that does is it allows us to be that way toward other people. Finally, it's a mark of a good leader. You know, the leaders that we follow, they should be characterized by compassion and mercy and forgiveness. And they should be preaching those things. And a Christian leader that's coming along teaching anything else, that should send off warning lights, warning bells in our minds. There's something wrong here. And I need to be on guard here. And this is not the kind of teacher that Jesus is talking about. This is more like the Pharisees that he's warning them against. So forgiving versus condemning, Jesus also says, give and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over will be poured into your lap. For with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. And so we see a second mark here And that's the difference between taking and giving. You know, the Pharisees were takers. False teachers are in it for personal gain. If you read your New Testament, you see they're motivated primarily by money, but also other stuff like sex. And so-called spiritual teachers, they're still in it for this today. And, you know, it couldn't be any more different from spiritual leaders and spiritual teachers, people who are like Christ and not like the Pharisees. Godly teachers are going to live simple lives. They're going to live generous lives. The kind of life that Jesus was living, the kind of life he's calling his disciples to live. And I think it's really suspicious when so-called Christian teachers are unbelievably wealthy and living in luxury. No, instead, because they've received so much from God, they can afford to be generous. They can afford to give out to other people. They're sacrificial. They're not living, you know, lives that are way above the other people who they're supposed to be leading. You know, Paul was like, look, we worked hard when we were among you. He didn't take anything from certain churches because he wanted to make sure that he made this point and not open himself up to accusation that actually applied to other false teachers. He had to especially guard against this right here. And he says it's a good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over will be poured into your lap. This is a reference to when they would go to the market and they would buy grain. They had these kind of folds in their shirts. And what they would do is they would go to the grain salesman and they'd pull that fold open and the guy would pour the grain in there, all right? But he wouldn't, and he'd pour it up to the top, but he wouldn't stop there. What'd he do? A generous grain salesman would take that, and then he'd kind of shake that, and it would kind of settle down, and then he'd pour some more in there, and he'd shake a little more, and then he'd pack it down, you know, and then he'd pour a little bit more on top, and he might even kind of fill it over so a little bit spills over the edges. You know, this is a practice that is not followed by today's cereal production companies. This right here might be my favorite food in the world. Kroger toasted oats. I eat this every day, not for breakfast. I eat oatmeal. But I eat it at some point throughout the day, especially late at night. Pretty much always after CT, you can see me sitting down to a bowl of toasted oats with raisins. But what's the deal with that bag? I'm always so disappointed when I open this up and I just realize it's half full or half empty, whatever. And the answer is so unsatisfying. It's that contents may settle during shipping. Contents may settle. Contents will settle every time. It's not like there's, I wonder if the contents will settle. You know, whatever. I guess we ship by weight, not by volume. But, you know, with God, the way God gives, contents do not settle during shipping. All right? You know, God, the way God blesses his people, the kind of generosity that he shows, the scripture says, eyes have not seen, ears have not heard. It hasn't even entered into the heart of any human. The blessings that God has stored up for those who love him. You know, God, you know, he pours the blessings on and then he shakes it down and then he pours some more on and then he shakes it and he pours and packs and he starts pounding it down and he pours even more and then he just keeps on pouring as it dumps over the side. As the psalmist said, my cup runneth over. And he keeps on pouring. Before you know it, you're up to your knees in blessing. And then he keeps on pouring and packing it down. And then you're up to your chin. And then you got to get your blessing snorkel out. Because God keeps pouring the blessing on. And then you got to eventually get your blessing inflatable swimmies. So you can float to the surface. Because God is a God who loves to give. God is love, the scriptures say. And I wish I could somehow communicate to you guys, all of the blessings that God has dumped into my life. And I simply just can't, I don't have enough command of the English language to communicate the generosity of God in my life. And we could summon a lot of other testimonies like that here in this room. You know, this, I just think about, you know, even today it's like, I wake up and I find myself not in hell where I deserve to be, but I find myself waking up, you know, with a fully functioning body, the ability to think, the ability to communicate on a planet that can sustain life, that's just the right distance from the sun, that has just the right atmosphere. I find I can get up, I can walk around, I can communicate, I have food to eat. I have a car to drive to work in. I can sit. I can watch that hour this morning where the sun broke through the clouds for a little while. You know, I realize God has given me yet another day of life that I didn't deserve. And even so, I'm also one day closer to spending eternity with Him. That's what today represents. And if you're a Christian, you can be guaranteed that you're one day closer every day when you wake up, one day closer to eternity with God. Not to mention my family, my relationships that God has dumped into my life, all of the gifts He's given me, the abilities He's given me. So many material blessings. Purpose, joy, which cannot be purchased. I don't know if you realize that. Purpose and joy. Closeness with other people. You can't buy that with money. You can't manufacture that. That comes from God. God has made me dead to sin and alive in Christ, and He's joined me to His Son. He's put His Spirit into me. He's joined me to so many other believers, so many close friendships. We're in a church where we've got not just this room full of people who are excited about following God, but several more like this, thousands of people of the same mind, intent on one purpose. You talk about the God that pours it out and shakes down and pats it in and keeps pouring until it overflows. This is the God we're dealing with. And godly teachers are going to live in this reality. This is going to be their lifeblood. The truth is that when it comes to following God, you get out of it what you put into it. I guess there's some Christians that wouldn't really say that about their lives. A lot of it is because they're completely ignoring blessings God's given them. They're failing to appreciate God has already just dumped out the blessing, and they're wondering, why does nothing ever go my way? The truth is, the more you put in, the more you're going to get out of it. There's a reciprocity here. The same thing in your relationships. If you live as a conduit of the love of God, if you believe what Jesus said, that it's better to give than to receive, then you're going to live as a conduit for His love, and you're going to see an improvement in your relationships. This is not the kind of thing where it's going to be immediate. You can't go in with all these demands on God. I'm going to try this for a week and see how it works. You can't put expectations on God about how He's going to come through. God gives in His time, in His way, for your good. But it will be a life lived in His generosity. Jesus said in Matthew 16:25, if you want to find your life, you'll need to lose it for my sake. That's how you find true life. And the Pharisees were takers. They were takers. Jesus was a giver. Teachers that are sent from Him are going to be givers. They're going to be generous because they've been around a generous God. And how could that not spill over into your relationships? He says He also told them this parable. Can the blind lead the blind? Will they not both fall into a pit? So here we see a third difference between bad teachers and good teachers. It's the difference between being blind and reliable. Blind and reliable. The Pharisees were blind. Imagine if you were blind and you spend all this money on a seeing eye dog, and then it turns out your seeing eye dog is blind too. What a ripoff. I would hope I save my receipt on that. You know, it's like, that's not what you need, all right? And the Pharisees, they were blind, and they're leading the people who are also blind. And Jesus says, you're going to fall into a deep hole. They're going to lead you in a bad direction. They're trusting you guys. This is why the stakes are high. He says teachers have a higher standard. If you're going to lead people for God, and it's bad news if you lead them astray, God's going to hold you more responsible. And so the Pharisees, they were leading people astray. They were totally blind. Jesus says, look, I am the only guide. I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. He says, I'm the way, and I'm the truth, and I'm the life. No one gets to the Father but through me. He's the only guide. He's the only one who knows the way. He was sent from God for this very purpose, to show us the way. And so Jesus says, don't follow the blind guys. You guys are blind enough as it is. Follow me. I'm the one who knows the way through the maze. In fact, he says the student is not above the teacher, but everyone who's fully trained will be like the teacher. If you follow the Pharisees, you're going to become just like them. They tend to make their converts into twice the sons of hell that they are, Jesus says. They become just as legalistic, just as judgmental, just as unhappy, just as hypocritical and just as poor representations of God as their teacher is. He says, on the other hand, if you follow me, not only will I show you the way, but I'll make you more like me. And that's way better. I will teach you how to be like I am. He's going to put his spirit inside of you. So you get this constant presence and power of the Holy Spirit. He says, why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? Jesus, he always uses this vivid imagery. He says, look, there's a plank. You know, the planks back then, they would have been, you know, it'd be bigger than our 2x4s. This was the main beam on the house. And so he's like, you know, here your brother's got a little speck in his eye, and you got this going. And you're like, hey, come here. And you got your pair of tweezers in one hand. I'm not letting that guy anywhere near my eyeballs. How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye when you yourself fail to see the plank in your own? You got this major problem, Pharisees, and you're plucking specks? You need to deal with your plank, your eye plank. You hypocrite! First, take the plank out of your eye, and then you'll see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Yeah, the eye is very sensitive. You don't just let anybody mess with your eye. I could barely touch my own eye. I remember when my wife got LASIK surgery a number of years ago. I was pretty freaked out by this, okay? You know, I had this LASIK surgery horror story nightmare in my mind where, you know, my wife's going to run out of the operating room with blood coming out of her eyes and screaming, and she's going to be blind the rest of her life and carry a mug around and stuff, you know. And so, you know, we go down to the clinic, right, where she's going to get this LASIK surgery. I mean, that's where they, you know, they like cut the top layer off your eye, flip it back, shoot it with lasers, flap it back over there. I mean, that's like margin of error is not real big on that, okay? So we go, and I think I'm more nervous than she is, all right? And so they're going to take her into the room, and they're like, Mr. Risley, would you like to watch the surgery? And I was like, hell yeah, I want to watch the surgery. Got to keep an eye on my wife. Maybe I could rescue her if I see them messing up. And so they're like, well, because of germs, you have to watch it from the room next door. I'm like, okay, I'm cool with that. I'm envisioning like a window into the operating room. I go into the room next door, and it's like this library-looking room, and there's just this 40-inch television sitting in there, okay? So, you know, so I grab a seat, and I'm sitting there. And I'm envisioning like a camera up in the corner of the operating room or whatever. The TV kicks on. And it's the camera that the doctor is using to get the close-up of her eyeball. So the TV kicks on, and I'm like, ah! It's this, my wife's eye, 40-inch diameter. And so I'm already freaking out. And then they get these tong things. And they're like pulling her eye open, and I see this knife come across. And they like take this, flip the flap over, and I see this laser shooting her eye. And I'm like, oh my God. I was so worried. She was fine, okay? But you know, I mean, imagine that doctor walks up to me and is like, let's just come back into the room, Miss Risley. I think we're ready for your surgery here. Okay. Jesus is like, this is ridiculous. You guys are not qualified to be removing specs. You're not qualified to be moving into people's lives and trying to help them get the speck out, because you have got, this is, you know, you've got such major problems here. This is a farce. And so what's our application here? Well, again, Jesus is the only one you should follow. You know, you think about something like your eye, which is pretty sensitive. You know, think about how much more important it is, your eternal destiny. And if I'm going to follow anybody, I want to make sure I've got a reliable doctor in there who knows what he's doing. And Jesus is the only one who knows what he's doing. He's the only one that knows the way. And so Jesus says, follow me, not them. They're hypocrites. Secondly, there's implications not just for how we're following Christ, but also how we're leading for him. You know, if we're not going to look at him, if we're not going to keep our eyes on him, we're going to be blind guides as well. Yeah, that's the difference between spiritual leadership and fleshly leadership. Spiritual leadership has learned how to wait on God, how to hear from him, how to listen to him, how to spend time with him. It's going to know his word, the things that he's spoken. And unless we're going to do that, we're going to be leading people astray. And so fortunately, Jesus offers to, when he calls us to serve him, he also supplies the power and the guidance to do that, but we still have to turn to him and wait on the Lord, as it says in the scriptures. Additionally, we can ask ourselves this question as well. Have you removed the plank so you can remove the speck? You know, speck removal is good. It's a task God calls us to. He calls us to love one another, to help one another, to help people see clearly, and to help them live for Jesus. But, you know, there's some work God's going to need to do in our own lives, some spiritual growth, and we need to be growing Christians if we're going to be able to help other people. Ken Sandy, in his book on conflict, The Peacemaker, he also applies this to resolving conflict with somebody. He says, you know, okay, you're in a conflict with this person. Maybe you're in the middle of a conflict right now with somebody. And you're so angry about what they did wrong and what they did to you, and you just are trying to tell them that, but they can't see it. And Jesus says, maybe you need to think about your contribution to this conflict. Maybe instead of feeling like a victim and feeling sorry for yourself, you need to think about, is there anything, maybe I didn't start it, maybe I'm not even to bear the majority of the blame, but is it really true that I've done nothing to contribute to this, either in how this started or the disaster that it has become? And it's going to totally change that conflict dynamic of you're wrong, no, you're wrong, no, you're wrong, no, you're wrong, and you say, I think I might be wrong. And that's going to change that pattern that's pretty hard to break out of. And it's going to put you in a position where maybe at some point you can also help them to get the speck out. There's a humility here that's going to pervade our relationships if we're willing to take Jesus up on this. Well, he goes on. He says, no good tree bears bad fruit, nor does a bad tree bear good fruit. Each tree is recognized by its own fruit. People do not pick figs from thorn bushes or grapes from briars. And so he moves over to agricultural imagery. And, you know, the difference here is the kind of fruit that bad teachers bear. He says bad teachers are going to bear bad fruit. Good teachers are going to bear good fruit. Just watch. See what kind of fruit is growing in their lives. And that's a good indicator of what's in the heart, of what's below the ground. You know, I had this tree I planted out on the east side of my house a couple years ago. And a tree, it should have grown into this really nice shade tree. It's a Yoshino cherry tree. Those are great trees. And, you know, it just kind of stayed the same size for the first year. I'm like, all right, maybe something will happen next year. Next year, grew a little bit, not like it should have grown, not like the other trees I planted. The next year, gets about halfway through summertime, and the leaves go from nice, bright, and green, they just go brown and shriveled. And I'm like, I don't think that's supposed to happen. I mean, everything else on the tree looks the same, except for the leaves on it. So I'm like, well, maybe it's just like hibernating early this year. Although usually the leaves drop, but, and so, you know, sure enough, next spring rolls around, that tree's got nothing, it's barren. And, you know, we dig it up, and sure enough, the roots are all tangled. It looks like one root was kind of wrapped around it as it grew, just choked the tree out. I'm not exactly sure what happened, but, you know, you don't have to be like a certified arborist to know that something is wrong with that tree. You know, it's kind of a common sense principle. You know, is this an apple tree? Well, are there apples on it? No. Maybe it's not an apple tree. Maybe if you wait a little bit longer, apples will come out. I mean, that's always possible. If, you know, fruit trees are not always bearing fruit. But, you know, if it looks like a thorn bush, I don't think you're going to get some grapes off of it. You're going to get pricked. You're going to get hurt. You're going to be bleeding. And you need to make sure if you want grapes, you go to a grape tree. And the Pharisees, Jesus is like, look at these guys. Come on. What kind of fruit are they bearing? You can't fake fruit. You can't pretend to be bearing fruit when there's something wrong with the roots, the root system. That's how you can tell, is by what is coming out of that tree. And he says, these guys, they're jerks, they're rich, they're oppressive, they're judgmental, they're self-righteous, they can't even see the true intent of God's law because they've made so many rules to ruin the things like the Sabbath, which should have been good. He's like, guys, just use some common sense. Watch these guys. And it's the same way with false teachers. You know, we can watch them over a period of time. We can see what kind of fruit is being born, and we can decide whether or not to follow them. Now he says it's because a good man brings good things out of the good stored up in his heart. Good roots, good fruit. An evil man brings evil things out of the evil stored up in his heart. For the mouth speaks what the heart is full of. Yeah, what people say as well, what they do, you know, it's this is the kind of fruit that's going to be born. And over time, that's going to become evident, Jesus says. You know, use your common sense. And so, you know, he talks about the good stored up in his heart. It's not like, you know, deep down we're all good. Now, with Jesus, the starting point for a good heart is Christ. It's a relationship with Christ. When we come to him for forgiveness, that's permanent. His spirit dwells inside of us, and he gives us a new nature. We're what the Bible calls born again. We become alive. He gives us spiritual life. It can't be generated, can't be manufactured any more than you could have given yourself your own life, okay? It's a gift from God to all who come to him. And so that good heart starts with Christ. The Bible says on our own, the heart is deceitful and it's desperately wicked, and who can understand it? But there is an alternative, which is to come to Christ and get a new heart. He says, I'm going to remove your heart of stone. I'm going to put a heart of flesh in you. I'm going to wash you clean, he says. And so that's got to start with a relationship with Christ. And then from that point forward, as that grows, it'll eventually bear fruit. Of course, we need to come under good teaching. We need to learn what the Bible says about spiritual growth. But fruit is the standard for leadership. And so things like character. You know, Galatians 5 talks about the fruits of the Spirit. And he says the fruits of the Spirit, the fruit of the Spirit is love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness and gentleness and self-control. Those are the kind of things that are going to sprout from Christians. In 1 Timothy, he says, if you're picking leaders, you need to look for certain characteristics, not a lover of money, patient, gentle, tested by the group and found reliable. Not somebody that just flies off the handle. Somebody who's stable, who's sensible, who's sane, who's loving, who's other-centered, who leads their family well. Those sorts of things. That's the kind of fruit that's going to be born from the Holy Spirit inside of us. Also, doctrine is another standard for leadership. He says you can recognize a good teacher from a bad teacher by the content of their teaching. He says test the spirits in 1 John 4. And so we hold out for doctrine, for leaders and teachers, also love. John says God is love in 1 John 4, 7 and following. And that's how you can tell somebody who's the real deal, because they're loving. You look around them, you look at the impact they're having on other people. They're not off away from everybody, mean, angry. No, they're down, they're engaged with people. They're not perfect. They're bearing fruit. And this standard, you know, we hold a high bar in this fellowship. If you want to lead, it's not just like raise your hand and you're a leader. In some churches, that's about all it takes. No, if you want to lead, we're gonna help you get there, but we're also gonna observe, not just over days and weeks, but over years, your relationships, your growth. Are you the real deal or are you a faker? And we're gonna teach you the word in a pretty rigorous way. The kind of rigor that exceeds what I got in seminary, in my opinion, in both its completeness and its usefulness. So we do hold a high bar for this. And Christian leaders need to hold a high bar. And you should know that Jesus is making you also responsible for who you follow. You can't just be like, well, my leader told me to. I'm off the hook. No. You're not a victim. You are somebody who is responsible to evaluate the fruit and decide whether or not this leader is really from God. Including me. I want you guys to have me under scrutiny and the other teachers that get up here. And if you feel like we're off base, come and talk to us. Come and talk to me. You know, we've got this vast system of checks and balances in this fellowship, but we try to teach everybody the word as much as possible and then all hold each other accountable. And we're pretty good, actually. I'm pretty proud of the Bible knowledge and discernment that we've got here in this fellowship. And the high standard for love, the high standard for leadership, and the character that we see. I think our ministry houses contribute a lot to this as well. When you get Christians living together, it's hard to be a faker. That's where the rough edges get rubbed off. And then finally, he says, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and you don't do what I say? So bad teachers versus good teachers, they're judgmental versus forgiving, they're takers versus givers, they're blind versus reliable, they're good fruit versus bad fruit, and finally, they ignore Jesus versus obeying Jesus. You look at their deeds, not their words only, but their deeds. And you know, this is what we call the good talk fallacy. This is where somebody says the right things and you feel like, okay, they're on the right track, but you haven't looked at their lives and you haven't seen that play out in their daily actions. And that's a big discernment error, just looking at people's words. And Jesus says, some people are like, oh, Jesus this and Jesus that, and their actions. They only talk the talk. They don't walk the walk. 1 John 3:18, he says, little children. He says, let's not love in word and in tongue, but in deed and in truth. Jesus says, if you know these things, you're going to be blessed if you do them in John 13:17. The blessing that comes from following God is only when we put into practice the things that he calls us to do, when we seek to follow him. Not that we follow perfectly, but that we follow him and we seek to live out his teachings and the way he calls on us to live. And he gives one final analogy here. He says, as for everyone who comes to me and hears my words and puts them into practice, I'll show you what they're like. They're like a man building a house who dug down deep and laid the foundation on rock. And when the flood came, the torrent struck that house but could not shake it because it was well built. Yeah, it takes time to lay a proper foundation. You can't just build right there on the sand. You got to dig down deep until you hit something solid to build that house on. On the other hand, he says, the one who hears my words and does not put them into practice is like a man who built a house on the ground without a foundation. He just lays it on the surface level. And he says, the moment the torrent, that flood struck that house, it collapsed and its destruction was complete. What a difference between an unshakable house and a house that collapses as soon as the floodwaters come. You know, foundation, it takes time. You know, you ever driving by like a construction site and it just seems like for months on end, all you see are bulldozers in a giant hole and they're like moving things around and there's cement trucks pulling up periodically and there's rebar. And you're like, man, when is that building? Buildings take forever to build. And then, you know, you drive by a couple weeks later and it's like, boom, there's the building. It seems like it just went up super quick. The reason why it seemed like it went up super quick, they were working at the same pace the whole time. It's just the foundation takes a lot of work. That's where they bring in the big, heavy-duty construction equipment because they got to dig down deep. Otherwise, if they don't, and the bigger the building is, the more impressive it is, the deeper and more solid the foundation has to be to support it. You know, I built a fence a couple years back, and, you know, I thought it would be pretty easy. Just dig 10 holes, put some posts in, and then attach the fence to it. But, you know, every hole, it's like you get in there, and there's rocks in there, and there's these massive tree roots. And, so, you know, I'm in there with, a spud bar and a mattock, and I got a sawzall down in there. I got my post hole digger, and each hole was a nightmare. It took so long, but I knew I can't just build this fence 6 or 12 inches deep. I got to go down 24 to 30 inches in Ohio to get down below the frost line. So that, you know, a couple of these winters come along and my fence is going to be all crooked and stuff. You got to go down deep so that it stays straight. And that's what Jesus says. He says, look, it's not your default is to do what I say. Following my teaching, there are times where it's difficult, but it's so worth it. It's so worth it. And the reason is because storms will come in this life. The flood will rise. If you haven't had that yet, just trust me, okay? Difficult times will come. And when those come, will you have a foundation? Or will it all be washed away? Will your life collapse and its destruction be complete? Pharisees were headed for disaster. Their followers were headed for disaster. You know, maybe they didn't necessarily hit it in this life. Although, life apart from God can be pretty miserable, whether we admit it or not. But ultimately, that final storm that comes, when you face death, which you will you be still standing after that comes? Will you have your foundation built on the rock? Will you have put Jesus' teachings into practice first and foremost, which was coming to him for forgiveness and seeking to live the way that he calls us to live? That's really the question that Jesus leaves us on in the Sermon on the Plain. He says in conclusion, where will your hope be? Where will you put your hope? He's the only rock. He's the only God. All the other ones are blind. All the other ones are so unstable. They're going to crumble. And you're going to push back against the storm and you're going to find the sand washing out from beneath your feet. As C.S. Lewis put it this way, he says, there's lots of nice things you can do with sand, but do not try building a house on it. You know, you can make a sand castle as long as you don't mind it being washed away by tomorrow. You could maybe make one of those like colored, layered sand things. Sand art. Building your house, though, not so good. And so, I mean, ask yourself, where are you going to put your hope? You're going to put your hope in your stuff? Where's that going to be when it's all washed away? If not sometime during your life when you face death. You're going to put your hope in your looks? I got news for you. Those are just going to get worse and worse. Spend all you want on them. Will you put your hope in people? People will let you down. There's only one person that won't let you down, and that's Jesus. People, you know, finding true love, your family, your friends, your the doctors. What are you going to hope in? Jesus is the only rock. And he calls on you to build your foundation on him and on his teaching. And what you'll find is that when the storm comes, you're going to find yourself standing as everything else washes away and as the delete button is hit on everything in this world. And God makes the whole world new. And you're going to be pretty glad that you did. So that's Sermon on the Plain. Yeah, I am thankful, Lord, that you're committed to this project, that you showed up as the way and the truth and the life and the light of the world, and you brought that truth and that guidance to anyone who could admit they were living in darkness and who would look to you for guidance and direction and leadership. God, I'm thankful that you've set us on the right path, and I pray that you would show us if there might be ways that we're off track. We're heading down the wrong path. We're following the wrong sign. Even if we're only slightly off track, God, I pray that you get us back on track. I agree, too, with that prayer that, you know, what you don't want us to do is to try to cosmetically change what sort of fruit we're producing, but you want us to look at some of the deeper issues that might be causing that fruit to go bad, and that you want to help us to work to change from the inside out, Lord. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.